So Marianne was honest and upfront in pointing out that she was a theist of sorts right at the beginning, and I'm going to be honest too and admit that I'm an atheist. I'm just curious, actually, as to how many atheists... I'll try and speak more loudly, but if you find that I'm inaudible or becoming inaudible, just let me know, okay?
I'll get you a microphone, just in case.
Can I have one? Because
yeah.
I'm a mumbler, that's the trouble. Yes. I'm ever so humble and quietly spoken. Is that going to work?
Well, you carry on.
I'll just carry on while Marianne does the technical stuff. So, so I'm going to talk a little bit about The God Delusion, the book, which I rather like, actually. You might expect me to say that because I am an atheist. But actually, there's plenty of atheist writing that I don't particularly like. I couldn't get that upset about The God Delusion. There are things in it that I don't like. There are mistakes in it. But there's also some extremely good writing. And there are some really quite interesting arguments worth thinking about in the book. And so, you know, by no means do I dislike the book or dismiss it as, you know, the work of some sort of fool, as has been the case. I mean, even some atheists have dismissed it in that way. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to give one example of a strength of Dawkins' book that I consider to be a strength of the book. I think there are several strengths. I'm not suggesting this is the only strength. What I'm going to focus on is his discussion of noma, as it's known, the principle that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria, the idea that somehow religious beliefs are immune to any kind of scientific critique or refutation. So I'm going to look at that, because I think what Dawkins has to say about that is quite good, and I think probably Marianne would agree with me about this. And then I'm going to look at the second half, I'm going to look at what I take to be Dawkins' central argument, or the key move, perhaps, in his central argument against the God hypothesis. I am not sure at all about it. I'm not entirely sure that Dawkins has got a good argument against the God hypothesis as he formulates it. So I'll be expressing my worries and giving you one or two quotes to think about from other philosophers. So that's what I'm going to do. So to begin with, just to remind you, the God hypothesis is the hypothesis that there exists a superhuman, supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed and created, that man's nodding, and created the universe and everything in it, including us. That's the hypothesis. There are many God hypotheses we might consider, of course. This is just one amongst many. Dawkins considers the God hypothesis a scientific hypothesis. I'm not entirely sure I know what he means by that. But what he certainly does say is that claims concerning the supernatural, such as this, are certainly not, in principle, off-limits and immune so far as scientific and or empirical confirmation or refutation or falsification are concerned. They can be scientifically assessed. He takes that view. And he himself, in this particular chapter that I'm going to be referring to, he looks at scientific investigations into the power of prayer, the efficacy of prayer, and that's already cropped up in the conversation. So Dawkins claims the God hypothesis is not, in principle, immune. to scientific refutation. And I think I agree with him about that. I think you agree with him about that as well, Marianne. It seems to me it rather the extent to which a God hypothesis is scientifically accessible or possibly scientifically refutable depends on the particular God hypothesis, of course. And I think that certainly if we were to add one or two more God properties, fairly standard God properties, such as omnipotence and supreme benevolence, properties which, if you're an Orthodox Jew or a Christian or Muslim, you know, you attribute to God. If we attribute to God those kinds of property, then actually the God hypothesis becomes really quite easily empirically refutable, it seems to me. I'll be talking about that later on. Why? Because such claims have empirically observable consequences. If there is a God like that, then you would expect to see certain things and not expect to see other certain things within the natural observable universe. And so we can look and check to see if things are as we would expect them to be. And they might not be like that, in which case we have some pretty powerful empirical evidence against the hypothesis. So, for example, and this is a hypothesis I'm going to be looking at in much more detail in the next session, but if we look at an alternative God hypothesis, it seems to me that it is just obviously, straightforwardly, empirically falsifiable and indeed empirically falsified. Take the hypothesis that the universe is the creation of a supernatural being, an intelligent being who designed it, and this being is all-powerful and supremely evil. His malice knows no bounds. His cruelty is beyond our imagination. Let's consider that particular God hypothesis. Who believes that? Nobody. Why? Because it's just perfectly obvious that there is no such being. Why is it perfectly obvious? Well, you know, look out the window. there's just way too much good stuff in the world. Way too much, you know, ice cream and rainbows and laughing children and so on. I know there's a lot of bad stuff too, but there's way too much good stuff in the world for this to be the creation of such a deity. And I think we all know that, and we can recognize that immediately. I'm not entirely sure I would call this a scientific refutation. It is an empirical refutation. It's based on observation of the natural world, and you know, we discover that it has certain features which provide us with very powerful evidence that there is no such deity. But I'm nervous about calling it a scientific refutation because, well, again, I'm not quite sure what a scientific refutation is, but you might think that in order to scientifically refute a claim, you have to use the scientific method, right? Now, the scientific method, as we know it, has only actually really existed for a few hundred years. It's only 400 or 500 years old, and it was developed by, you know, thinkers like Bacon, Francis Bacon, and so on. But people were empirically refuting hypotheses long before the discovery or the invention or the creation of the scientific method, and they were doing so very, very effectively. You can provide, you know, fantastically good, effective, empirical refutations of claims without using the scientific method. And I feel uncomfortable about calling them scientific refutations, but they are empirical refutations, and they can be devastatingly effective. And it seems to me we've got one here. We ain't doing science when we conclude that there is no evil God. This is the kind of common or God and common sense empirical refutation that we all engage in, you know, every day of our lives. We're familiar with this kind of reasoning. It's very effective, and it seems to me that it's a nice example of a God hypothesis being empirically refuted. God hypotheses are not, simply because we stick God behind some kind of veil and say, oh, he's behind there in the supernatural bit, not in this bit, the natural bit, therefore he's immune. You know, he can't be touched. Well, the evil god's behind that veil, and we've just shown pretty conclusively there ain't no such being back there. We may not know everything about what's behind the veil, but we can be pretty damn sure there ain't an evil god behind it because of what we would otherwise expect to see in the natural world around us. So we know we can be humble, and we can say we don't know all the answers, but we can still be very sure there ain't an evil god back there, justifiably so. And then that raises the possibility that the good god hypothesis might also be empirically and or scientifically refuted in much the same kind of way. I can't see any reason why one god hypothesis not only could be but is empirically refuted, but the other one somehow is mysteriously immune to being empirically refuted. Why? Well, there is no reason why it is an empirically refuted. Potentially, it's an empirically refutable hypothesis.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yeah.
It's not fairly obvious to me when I think of the wars, the genocide, the sickness. I don't think the world's such a wonderful place.
No, it's not.
It's nasty for most of its inhabitants.
Yes. It is.
Are
you
going to?
You're not. You think you're.
If there is one, he could equally well be evil.
There could be an evil god. Okay. Well.
Why can't you just have a capricious god?
Now that's a much more reasonable. That's a much more reasonable hypothesis. See, there's a whole range of even if we're going for one god, we could make him, you know, morally ambivalent. You know, he don't care one way or the other. Or he could have moral properties and be supremely good. Or he could have moral properties and be supremely evil. Let me just finish this sentence. If we say that he's supremely evil and all-powerful, we have the problem that although there is bad stuff in the universe, it's undeniable, and of course people who believed in an evil god, if they existed, you could be sure they would be pointing to all of that stuff and say, look at cancer, and look at that volcano exploding. It's obvious, isn't it, that there's an evil
god.
But while all of that is true, there is way, way too much good stuff in the world. Far too much, I would suggest, for this plausibly. You know, love and laughter and rainbows. I mean, evil god don't like, you know, love for a start. It makes him sick. And so he's not gonna fill the world with little bundles of joy that we love unconditionally and love us unconditionally in return, i.e. children.
I find it interesting that this omnipotent god, and this is what we're assuming for the moment, who creates everything,
yes,
has also created our concepts of good and evil, and that we are now using concepts of good and evil that were given to us by God to condemn God or to praise him. I find that a very I don't know how much it bears on what you're saying.
Is this a way of trying to defend belief in God against the arguments that I'm running?
Not at all. It does rather throw a bit of doubt over the terms we're using if we are assuming,
Well, you have to be
logically that God exists for the sake of
argument. Yeah.
Now, God exists in the terms that the God hypothesis by Dawkins would be an omnipotent God, a God that created us. Does he not say? And therefore, he's created everything about us, including our concepts. Yes.
Yes.
Including our values.
Hmm.
And among those values are the concept of evil and the concept of good.
Mm-hmm.
And we are using them, among other things, to condemn.
See, you are trying to defend belief in God. Yeah, that won't work. That's a bog standard. No. That is a... I'm saying rudely dismissive, which I mustn't do. But that is a fairly bog standard move that people make in order to try and deal with the problem of evil. They say, but you, Mr. Atheist, are using the concepts of good and evil, which came from God, and so your very argument presupposes that God exists. Is that a good objection? No, it's terrible.
I'm working from the basis, for the sake of argument, of those who say that God does exist, in the sense they say, and then they condemn him, or it, or her, or whatever it is, for producing evil things or good things. And he's given them the tools by which they can make these judgments.
Look, I'm neither supporting nor arguing against those people, so I don't want to bring him into the conversation. I'm running an argument against the existence of God, a very, very simple one. It doesn't actually require that I believe in good and evil, actually, interestingly. We should be careful, because actually the terms evil and good are already loaded, aren't they? They have connotations, don't they? And so and you might think they're, you know, divine connotations, evil and good. And so it might be better if the problem of evil were not called the problem of evil, actually. It might be better if it were called something like the problem of suffering, which is what some people call it. So, you know, why is there so much pain and suffering in the world? We don't have to call it evil. You know, why is there so much pain and suffering? Hundreds of millions of years of sentient creatures going through the most appalling anguish and horror, literally unimaginable quantities of it. Isn't this extraordinarily good evidence that there's no supremely benevolent and caring deity in charge of the universe? You know, someone who's supposedly cares for sentient creatures and worries and is concerned about pain and suffering. So you can set the problem up without using the vocabulary of evil. And indeed, you can, even as an atheist, you can still set the problem up, because you can say, even if it were true, which it isn't, that atheists are not entitled to talk about good and bad and right and wrong, the atheist could be a moral nihilist and say, there's no such thing as good, there's no such thing as bad, but you, Mr. Christian, or whatever it is, you think there is, don't you? You're committed to that vocabulary, you're committed to some things being good and some things being bad, and you think gratuitous suffering is bad, and so my question to you is, how do you square that with your belief in a good God, using your vocabulary, not a vocabulary I even have to sign up to? So you can run the problem of evil or suffering without even signing up to the moral vocabulary yourself. So this is a very popular way of trying to deal with the problem of evil or the problem of suffering. Theists often make this move, but actually it doesn't work. It doesn't get them off the hook. So I'm going to leave that point and move on, because I realise I've got quite a lot of stuff here I want to get through. So the next thing I wanted to say is Dawkins rejects the principle Stephen Jay Gould came up with, the NOMA principle, as it's sometimes known. That's the acronym Gould came up with. The principle that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria. The idea that there's this area and that belongs to science, that would be the natural realm, you know, the observable universe. And then over here we have the other stuff, whatever it is exactly, you know, perhaps a supernatural realm. And scientists are, you know, they're authorized, qualified to talk about this bit, but were they to kind of step over the margin and start talking about what's over here, oh, no, you can't do that. You're out of your area of jurisdiction and expertise. You're not qualified. You certainly can't use your scientific methods to draw conclusions about what's over here. This is the territory that belongs to religion and religious experts. They're the people to whom we should go if you want answers about what's behind the veil, as it were. So there is this very popular distinction, this very popular principle to which theists very often appeal when you start running empirical arguments against what they believe. They'll say, oh, you arrogant scientistic, whatever it is, scientist, philosopher, you know, you seem to think that, you know, our minds are such and our scientific method is such that it can answer every question and it can reveal how things are beyond the natural realm. But of course, it can't do that. We all know that. It can't do that. And so, you know, show a little humility, why don't you? No, well, to be fair, those who run the NOMA type principle will generally say religious people should butt out when it comes to science, actually. You shouldn't have religious people telling us that this is how living creatures appeared, contradicting what scientists have to say. So to be fair, Those who sign up to NOMA generally take that line. They are reasonably even-handed, up to a point, anyway. There is a kind of ratchet involved, which I'll come to, perhaps. I think the NOMA is, in effect, a version of what I call, this is my label, the veil doctrine. I've already mentioned it. On one side of the veil, this side, is the empirically observable natural world. On the other side, that's the supernatural realm or some kind of mysterious realm. And science isn't qualified to comment, give an opinion about what's on the other side of the veil. And the veil doctrine is used to immunise all sorts of supernatural claims against scientific and empirical refutation. The veil doctrine is kind of broader than NOMA because the veil doctrine concerns the supernatural generally, and so you'll find the veil doctrine being used to immunise claims made by psychics or crystal healers or, you know, you name it, any of those new agey, supernaturally kind of belief systems, you'll find people saying, oh, no, science, you see, it can't deal with, it can't assess these kind of claims. It doesn't have the right kind of methods to assess the claims of psychics or crystal healing or whatever it may happen to be. This is not really religion at all, but it's still the same kind of strategy which is being applied. And here's an example, actually. Chris French, do any of you know Chris French or know of him? He's a good chap. He's a psychologist, works in the area of anomalous psychology, is the label that he prefers. And he did some experiments on crystal healing. Actually, not so much the healing, on the claim that they have this, crystals have this detectable influence on your psyche, which you can detect simply by holding it in your hand. To anyone can do this. It's not like you have to be some specially trained person. If you hold a crystal in your hand, it will have, or it's likely to have, certain kinds of effect on you, perhaps giving you a sense of calm and peace, perhaps giving you a sense of empowerment. All sorts of effects are claimed about these crystals. And so what Chris and some other people did was they conducted a double-blind experiment. And they got real crystals and then they got fake crystals, glass or paste. And they had a group that were given the real crystals, a group that were given the fakes. And they both groups were told, these are crystals and they might have some interesting effects on your psyche. Why don't you hold it for a little while and have a little meditate and tell us what it is that you're detecting? And neither the subjects nor the people that were running the experiment knew which crystals were real and which were fakes. It was a double-blind test. And lo and behold... The two groups produced exactly the same results. It appears that what's really going on is not that the crystals have any effect, but the power of suggestion has an effect, and that has the same effect in both cases. It doesn't really matter whether you're holding a real crystal or not. So this experiment, people might say, "Oh, that's merely an absence of evidence for the powers of crystals." But it's not actually. It's evidence of an absence. What we've got here is pretty good evidence that there simply ain't no such effect. Crystals just don't do that kind of thing. And it's one piece of evidence, and you might want to repeat the experiment and change various things and so on. But the more such evidence we acquire, such empirical evidence that we acquire, the more it's reasonable for us to conclude that crystals really don't do that kind of thing at all. They may have some other powers. I mean, maybe they can still heal you, I don't know, and we could test that too. But the point is that this specific claim about what crystals do was empirically tested, and it failed spectacularly. And in fact, we do have pretty good evidence now that crystals simply don't have that kind of effect. To which somebody responded on a blog, there is much that exists beyond the visible spectrum of light and beyond the five senses. Not being able to prove the existence of something does not disprove its existence. Much is yet to be discovered. You would do better to discover it by looking outside your narrow frame of reference, was the kind of response that we got to this experiment. And it is, it's a kind of, it's hard to know where to begin with this. There is much that exists beyond the visible spectrum of light. Well, that's true, isn't it? Because, you know, ultraviolet exists beyond the visible spectrum of light. But presumably they're hinting at something rather more exotic, something of a supernatural nature, but it's not clear really what's going on. And beyond the five senses, yes, yeah, I mean electrons, you can't see them. Not being able to prove the existence of something does not disprove its existence. True. Absolutely true, but completely irrelevant, because what we're looking at here actually is something like a disproof, something approaching it. But they simply refuse to acknowledge that and pretend it's merely an absence of evidence rather than evidence of an absence. Misrepresent the character of the experiment, portray it as something that it is not. Much is yet to be discovered, another truism. We can all agree with that. you would do better to discover it by looking outside your narrow frame of reference. What's that mean? Science, I guess. Scientific method. So, well, it'd be interesting to know what they have in mind, but I mean, if you were to peruse the websites of crystal healers, it looks like the alternative method would be relying on lots of anecdotes and gut feeling. I mean, that's the alternative method, an alternative method which can be used to support pretty much any belief you like. So it's just, well, it's bullshit, isn't it? It's evasive bullshit designed to immunise the belief against an apparently pretty strong evidence, apparently an empirical refutation of a particular claim about crystal healing. So crops up all over the place, this kind of strategy. Let's look a little bit more at NOMA now, the principle that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria. You often find NOMA combined with an accusation, and the accusation is scientism, which actually means a number of different things. But what it means in this context is that science can answer every question, every legitimate question, every bona fide legitimate question. Science ultimately is in principle capable of answering it. That's scientism. And often, when the accusation of scientism is made, it's often kind of personalised to some extent. You know, you, with your fancy scientific method, you are arrogantly assuming that science can answer every question. You know, show a little humility, you know, like what I do, and acknowledge that there are things beyond the ability of science to comprehend or explain or whatever. So often this crops up, famous quotation, of course, from Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. That was from memory and I might have got it wrong, but it was something like that. Anyway, if you ever come across that quote in any kind of discussion of, you know where they're coming from, don't you? It's a kind of, you know, sweep it all aside, you know, show a little humility. Science, ultimately, you know, it's limited. It has nothing to say about this domain. This domain is immune to scientific refutation, to scientific investigation. So it's often wheeled out to defend theism, and it often comes with this kind of ad hominem character to it. It's kind of personalised. It's We don't just accuse the person of scientism, we suggest that they're kind of a naive fool. That's woven in. Is scientism true? Well, almost certainly not, actually. And Marianne has already been doing some work explaining why scientism is probably not true. I would have picked a different example, or I would have added another one, which is that, you know, moral questions are questions science can't answer. Science can have something to say. Did you? Well, you'd use the utilitarianism example. Yeah, but I was going to use the Yeats or Hume things. So, you know, science deals with the is realm, what is the case, whereas morality deals with what one ought or ought not to do. And you can't squeeze, rationally speaking, an ought out of an is Hume's famous point. And I agree with Hume about that. It seems to me that science, then, is ultimately incapable of justifying moral positions, providing us with answers to moral questions. It can help. It's not like it's completely useless, because very often moral questions have a kind of empirical or scientific component to them. You know, should we treat women differently to men? Well, in part, the argument turns on certain empirical facts about women and men and their, you know, their mental capabilities. People used to justify treating women differently on the grounds that they just weren't up to it. You know, they just weren't capable of thinking things through like men are, which is all empirically demonstrable cobblers. We know that now. So science has a role, but it ultimately, it's a subsidiary role. You only get an ought out of an argument if you've smuggled one in somewhere along the lines. So ultimately, your oughts cannot be justified by science. So it seems to me that, you know, moral questions, big, important questions, science can't answer. Science can make certain technologies possible, genetic engineering and so on, but it can't tell us whether or not we should do these things. So scientism, false. Is to reject Noma to embrace scientism? That's my question for you. Is to reject the view that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria? If you reject that, do you embrace scientism?
No.
No, of course you don't. No. So, just because you reject the principle that science is incapable of assessing, in principle, certain religious beliefs, it doesn't follow from that that you're wedded to scientism. Absolutely not. You might agree that science is ultimately incapable of answering moral questions. You may go, oh, yeah, absolutely, I agree with that. But that's irrelevant, because my point is, science can have something to say about this particular claim, this particular supernatural claim. So accusing people of scientism is very often a red herring. I'll come back to that point in a minute. So Dawkins is right, I think, that Noma is often wheeled out without justification to deal with scientific and empirical arguments against the God hypothesis. I think he's also right that if there were any evidence for the God hypothesis, fairly good-looking evidence, Noma would be dropped like a hot potato by the theists. Or rather, what actually happens is this. It's used as a kind of a ratchet, I think. What happens is that theistic scientists are... or those theists with an interest in science who think science has something to might help them a little bit in propping up their theism, will point to the bacterial flagellum or the fine-tuning stuff and go, oh, look, that's quite suggestive, isn't it? I mean, it's not a proof. You can't prove that there's a God, but, oh, look, it's really kind of making my belief look quite reasonable, isn't it? And so Noma is kind of put slightly into the background until you suddenly point out hundreds of millions of years of animal suffering, and suddenly, whoa, Noma's back. No empirical evidence. No, you see, that can't really threaten belief in God. So there's a ratchet. When the evidence goes their way, Noma downplayed. When the evidence starts coming up that's against what they believe, oh, no, Noma suddenly rears its head and it starts to be applied far more vigorously. And I think that kind of ratchet is unfair. It's an unfair way of arguing. Yeah.
I think there's a bit of an imbalance coming in here. I know you've got the beautiful view of Jesus, but choosing the words that will keep you on course. And you did make it clear, just as Dawkins did, that some people use that defence mechanism.
Yes.
But as your talk is going on, it's becoming more and more as if it's a generalisation.
No,
not as if there's a... I don't know how Dawkins actually has assessed just what mainstream Christianity's attitude is towards science. But I can imagine it's pretty open-minded, because science actually does quite a lot to get Christians off wrong courses and actually also support theories that they have.
I don't want to... I'm really steamrollering Noma here, because I really don't like it. I find it hugely annoying and irritating the way it's endlessly trotted out by even quite scientifically literate theists. But I do not want to suggest that all theists are guilty of running this, because they are not. And towards the end, I'm going to give you some examples of bona fide, quite interesting criticisms of Dawkins' position. So we don't want to tar everyone with the same brush, but those that are guilty of this, I want to make sure they are thoroughly tarred. Right? And so we'll be coming to an example in a minute. Alistair McGrath. Yeah.
You accept that there are some things which are in a different kind of regime or different world from science.
There are questions science can't answer, definitely, yeah.
But questions which science can't answer.
Yeah.
What do you think that the questions which science can't answer have in common?
Were you going to suggest they all have something to do with God? I don't know. What do you think they all have in common?
Is religion one of those things?
Not really. I mean, religion tends to focus on those kind of questions, but it doesn't own them. Actually, philosophy also addresses those kind of questions, and in fact was addressing those kind of questions long before Christianity came along, and in fact was doing so in a very interesting, stimulating ways. Now, I'm not quite sure where you're going with that.
The thing is, there are a whole load of things out there.
Right? Mm.
You know, take the rules of cricket, take the plot of the Clangers. Right?
Mm.
Everyone would say that science can falsify the plot of the Clangers.
Right? Well, it doesn't make a claim. You can't falsify it.
It can falsify a story.
No, because they don't make any claims. Yeah,
but
it's not a hypothesis.
You know, if you look at Alice in Wonderland, it makes a particular claim. And, you know, the thing is that not everything does the same kind of work, does it? And I think this is.
I know literature. Yeah, you know, if you think literature is valuable, of course it is. Gets us to think and consider the big questions and.
Why is religion? You know, if you say.
Is that all religion is then? Because it doesn't make a claim.
But it just makes it's just a different.
Or if it does, science might falsify it.
It's a different kind of thing, isn't it?
I mean, it might make a psychological claim. It might make a claim about how people's minds work, and it might subsequently turn out that claim is not true. So the claim made within the story might actually turn out to be scientifically.
If you look at religion, the role that religion has in people's lives, it gives them a kind of theory about what they do with their life, what is a good life, what happens to you after you die.
Yeah.
All these kinds of things.
Are scientifically accessible.
They're not necessarily scientific claims.
Well, actually, some of them are. If there is an afterlife, it is potentially scientifically or empirically accessible.
Yeah, but I don't know, monopolist conversation, but yeah. the difficulty is that it's just... what I'm saying is what these kinds of things are is they are more similar to a story or a myth or a fable.
If they were merely stories, there would be nothing to falsify. But
yeah, most of the Bible is just full of stories, isn't it?
Yeah, but those who are religious don't think they're just a bunch of stories, like the stories that you might find in some other book. They do make claims, most of them, unless they're apophatists or whatever the word is. we could talk about those later on. I mean, the thing about making a claim is that you stick your neck out and you take a risk, and if you're worried that your belief might turn out to be false, it's very tempting to appeal to certain philosophical or linguistic theories to, which point out that not everything we do with language is making a claim. Sometimes we express attitudes, for example. And so if you were to recast God exists as expressive of an attitude, well then your belief cannot be empirically refuted because you're not making any kind of claim at all. So Wittgenstein suggested that perhaps that is how religious language is used. There are those strategies that you can adopt. You can say, oh, religious people aren't making any claims at all, but that will come as a surprise to the vast majority of religious people, I think.
It's too much to ask the scientists that they can see that there are people that ask unscientific questions. And therefore, they can't answer. Is that too much for expect?
Well, let's find out. Let's find out exactly what, for example, Richard Dawkins says about that. Let's move on. Here's Alistair McGrath. Here's Alistair McGrath, who I'm sure is well known to many of you, is a professor of theology, or history of theology, I think is his correct title. And he was also, by training, a scientist, and he might have completed a doctorate in science, in chemistry, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. Anyway, Alistair McGrath is a great critic of Dawkins, has written several books with the name Dawkins in the title, including The Dawkins Delusion. And in this is an example of, perhaps it's a little unfair, because this is a newspaper article that McGrath wrote, attacking Dawkins. And in the article, this is what McGrath says. In The Limits of Science, Peter Medawar, famous scientist, reflected on how science, despite being the most successful enterprise human beings have ever engaged upon, had limits to its scope. Science is superb when it comes to showing that the chemical formula for water is H2O, or more significantly, that DNA has a double helix. But what of that greater question, what's life all about? What has science got to say about that? And the answer, of course, is not very much. This and others like it, Medawar insists, were questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. So McGrath is pointing out that there are limits to the scientific enterprise, and I mean, I agree with him about that. So far, so good. But he then accuses Dawkins of scientism, of supposing that, and I quote, science has all the answers. And McGrath, again, surely correct to reject scientism. Has, though, McGrath now shown that Dawkins is wrong to suppose that the God hypothesis is scientifically accessible? Because that's where we end up in the article. You know, scientism. Dawkins is guilty of scientism, and, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. There are questions science can't answer. So it seems then that the God hypothesis, it's not scientifically accessible. Does that follow? And the answer is, of course, it doesn't. This is Dawkins himself in the book on scientism rejecting it. He says, perhaps there are some, or at least being ambivalent about it, perhaps there are some genuinely profound and meaningful questions that are forever beyond the reach of science, he says, quite unambiguously. He is not committed to the view that necessarily every legitimate question can be answered by science. He has never said that, he's never committed himself to that, and yet time and time and time and time again, we are told that that's what his position is. It is not his position. He is not wedded to scientism. In fact, he seems happy to concede that moral questions may well fall into this category. He says, we can all agree that science's entitlement to advise us on moral values is problematic, to say the least. What could be clearer than that? He's not wedded to scientism. He does reject Noma. He does believe the God hypothesis is scientifically accessible. But that doesn't mean that he's committed to scientism. So McGrath is missing the target when he accuses Dawkins of being wedded to scientism. Interestingly, nowhere within McGrath's article does he attempt to refute any of Dawkins' arguments against the God hypothesis. He simply wheels out this sweeping condemnation, you know, that Dawkins is an arrogant fool for presuming to apply science to what he believes in. To show scientism is false is not to establish that the God hypothesis is immune to empirical refutation. McGrath does not, it's certainly not in this article, offer any justification of Noma. And in fact, interestingly, in the discussion of Noma in the book, McGrath is quoted by Dawkins, and Dawkins points out that nowhere does McGrath ever justify the use of Noma. So it's kind of ironic then that Dawkins is now being attacked using Noma without any justification. McGrath simply asserts that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria, that science cannot undermine the claims of religion. So it seems to me that this is... I just find this very, very irritating indeed, I have to say. When people like McGrath play this kind of card in order to get themselves out of jail. I mean, I'm not entirely sure whether McGrath really believes it himself. I mean, he's an intelligent man. How could he not realise that there's something not quite right about the moves that he's making here? Yeah.
I certainly agree with you, and I think there must be a whole chapter that Dawkins has in what he calls the moral zeitgeist, which is nothing that derives itself from science. So there may be some scientific ideas in there, but it is philosophical ideas, it's ideas of the time, it's moral values of the time. And that's where he basically says we have to make these moral decisions.
So yeah.
I find that correct.
Yeah. Having said that, I think that Dawkins on morality, that's his weakest. That's where he's weakest. But there wasn't time to include that in this little talk.
So, not just the word all missing, but science, I'm not saying you meant to put it in, but if you say that science cannot undermine all the claims of religion, then we don't have a problem.
Sorry, I've lost track now. I did have to change the version you have. I started fiddling around with this on the way here, so it's not quite the same, the printed version. It's just going to cause some confusion, possibly. But sorry, just...
I'm reading from this bit. McGrath simply asserts that science and religion are non-overlapping with magisteria, that science cannot undermine the claims of religion. But if just for all the claims of religion, it's okay.
It may be that science can't understand, but remember that Dawkins is suggesting that science can undermine one particular claim, and what McGrath is doing is playing a universal, no, it can't undermine any of them, and it's only if it's that strong that he can use it against Dawkins. Otherwise, can Dawkins turn around and say, yeah, but mine's one of the ones that...
Dawkins is happy to say moral values may be outside of science, so religion asserts some moral values. Other things besides religion can, but religion does.
Yeah, so there are things that religion... There are claims that religion puts forward that science cannot contradict. How does that help McGrath deal with Dawkins? Not at all.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
Are you getting the idea of God mixed up with religion?
Well, I'm deferring to the religious in characterising God. I've used the bog standard.
That's a very limited attitude.
Yeah, you might be right, but... Well, you may be right. There are many... I mean, look, there are so many God hypotheses we might consider. We'll stick with McGrath and Dawkins on this particular one for the time being. Let me carry... By this, what time have we got to finish, by the way?
6:30 Okay. 6:30 we go to the bar.
Yeah, we want to be done by then. Definitely. Yeah, okay. So let me carry on a bit, and then there'll be more opportunity for you to ask questions at the end, I promise, then. We're going to be okay. So it seems to me that Dawkins' scientifically based arguments may or may not be good arguments. I'm not endorsing them. In fact, in a little while, I'll suggest that actually his central argument looks a bit dodgy, actually. It's not like I'm wedded to Dawkins and I will, unfailingly support him no matter what. I'm merely pointing out that he's got one or two things right, and I think he is right about Noma. But what the one thing you can't do, that I'm not quoting McGrath here, by the way, but if whenever somebody raises an empirical or scientific problem for your theism, if you say, oh, roll your eyes and say, you arrogant fool, you're using the science to assess belief in God, that's scientism. There are questions science can't answer. Show a little humility. There are more things in heaven and earth than I dreamt of in your philosophy, Professor Dawkins. If that's the card you play every time someone like Dawkins provides evidence against what you believe, well, that's not intellectually credible, to say the least. It's just throwing dust in the air and hoping to blind your opponent. It's smokescreen with a bit of ad hominem personal attack thrown in. And he gets an awful lot of this. He gets some good criticisms too. I'm not saying he doesn't, but he does, unfortunately, get an awful lot of this kind of smokescreen and personal attacks, which are simply not justified, so far as I am concerned. And Marianne, I think, would broadly speaking agree with me about that, but we'll find out later. So that bit I liked. So I'm now going to turn to an assessment of Dawkins' main argument against the God hypothesis. And to be honest, I haven't had enough time to think about this myself. So if I appear to be struggling, it's because I am a bit. This is quite hard work. This, I take it, is his main argument. He takes the theistic claim that our fine-tuned universe has such organized complexity that it is highly improbable it should just happen to exist. I mean, that's what those who run fine-tuning type arguments say, isn't it? What are the chances that the universe should have the Goldilocks property of being just right for life? What are the chances that it should have that property by chance? Extraordinarily low. It's more reasonable then to suppose that someone, some kind of intelligence, deliberately designed that way, deliberately set the levers of the universe in such a position as to produce a stable universe capable of producing intelligent life. So what Dawkins does is, he then says, well, I'm just going to apply the same logic then to God, whom you have wheeled out in order to account for this organized complexity. It seems to me that God must himself have as much organized complexity as that which you're using him to explain. And so you're merely using one improbable thing in order to account for the existence of another improbable thing. I mean, so what's the justification for introducing the second improbable thing? There is none whatsoever. We have entirely undermined this particular argument for the existence of God. And indeed, if the kind of logic which is being applied here is good, then we should conclude that God himself is highly improbable. And that is the conclusion that Dawkins draws. And that I take it, is the core argument. Dawkins says, a designer God cannot be used to explain organized complexity because any God capable of designing anything would have to be complex enough to demand the same kind of explanation in his own right. God presents an infinite regress from which he cannot help us escape. So it's the same old problem, he thinks, that theists have always had, which is when you wheel out God to explain something, you then have to explain why God exists or why God has that property or whatever. It's the same old regress type problem. And that's it. That is the core argument, I think. It's remarkably simple. It doesn't really look anything like the argument. Doesn't look anything like the argument that Marianne presented. But yes, shall I go? It's so he takes the theistic claim that our fine-tuned universe has such organized complexity it is highly improbable it should just happen to exist. Right? What are the chances that the universe should be just right for life, say? There must be a God who made it that way. Dawkins then says, well, hang on, because the God who created the universe would have to be at least have at least as much organizational complexity as the thing that you're invoking him to explain. And so there is no justification for introducing him. And indeed, if we claim that being highly complex organizationally, that's the right expression, it makes you improbable, that would just make God himself improbable. That's why God is highly improbable. That's his core argument.
There were many people who would not subscribe to either of those statements.
Sorry, which ones? The ones that he's putting forward.
God is improbable, and that therefore God is improbable.
Yes, that may be true. Yeah. I'm not endorsing the fine-tuning type argument. Of course, and he doesn't either. is this a good argument? Theists obviously typically don't think it is. What of the claim that God is not complicated? He's simple. What could be simpler than God? He's the simplest thing there is, basically. So Richard Swinburne, for example, says that God is a simple thing. So we're explaining organized complexity in terms of something essentially very, very simple. And so that's a good thing. It's a bit like accounting for, you know, all of these patterns in the bubble chambers and all of this chemical activity and so on. It's all so complicated, but if I simply posit an electron with a couple of simple properties, voila. It's all accounted for. What could be more economical than that? And that justifies my introducing the electron as a hypothetical entity. And so similarly with God. God is a simple thing with a few simple properties. Wheel in God and voila, all of that organized complexity is accounted for. And it's no longer improbable at all, given that there is a God. So that's the kind of objection that Dawkins is going to immediately going to run into. And he knows it, of course. And he rejects the claim that God is simple. He just says, how could he be? How could God be simple? Because, you know, he's produced something extraordinarily complex and he's designed it. He's an intelligence that's designed it. So how could he be any less complicated than the thing he designed? It's not entirely clear what the argument for that bit is. So I've provided a suggestion. It's this. If God designs the universe, all its complexity must be represented in God's mind. Right? That looks okay, doesn't it? But a representation must possess at least as much organized complexity as what it represents. Looks okay too, doesn't it?
No.
Oh. Why not? What's the matter with that then?
So much of existence is based upon projection.
I don't know what that means.
Well, the life itself is a bit of an illusion, and therefore that which we may project onto the mind of God is something which is internalized in the first place in our own psyche.
Well, yeah, we might be making a mistake in thinking that he's any kind of designer at all, and that's just a projection. I agree. But if he is, how could he fail? I mean, he's a designer, he's intelligent, he has thoughts. How could his thoughts be less complex in their structure?
You're suggesting he has a personality.
Not necessarily a personality, but if he's a designer and he's intelligent... Well, that's the hypothesis we're considering. You can have another one. We'll talk about that one later. Yes?
Perhaps confusing simplicity with lack of power. Because what people who believe in both science and God would say is that he simply laid down the ground rules and then left the system. He would carry on Earth by itself and develop all these complex, organized structures in accordance with those fundamental rules.
But if he planned it...
God didn't directly intervene after that.
Yeah, but if he knew what was going to happen and he set it up with a certain initial conditions knowing what the end result would be, despite the fact that he didn't have to then get involved himself, he just had to crank the starting handle, if he nevertheless did it with the intention that it should produce those complex things, if that was his plan, then the idea of those things must have been in his mind.
Who is this art savvy that said, as a word, world was created by just chance. The one that this argument is not. Who is it that, or what is it that said, has put forward the alternative that the world has been developed by chance in this way? I mean,
Bertrand Russell once said, you know, it just is. There just is no explanation. That's just the way it is.
The nearest thing is Darwin, but the mutations, which you can't explain. I mean, that is his starting point.
There
are mutations. But he doesn't go into what causes the mutation.
No.
There's an element of chance there. Well,
that's the right. We're not attempting to answer the question, why does the universe exist, or why does it have the observable features that it does? We can talk about that next time.
We're looking at
a specific argument against Dawkins' argument, an attempt to refute. So let's just stick with that for the time being. So Dawkins runs his argument. He says that God would have to be at least as complex as the thing that he designs. He doesn't give any very clear idea of why we should accept that, and so I'm merely providing for this, you know, accept it for the sake of argument. Suppose something like this were true, then we could at least get. I'm not saying this is true, by the way. I'm merely trying to fill in some gaps for Dawkins to try and show why you might think God would have to be complex.
He's saying all this stuff, but he's answering. He's contesting this accusation that others have said this is, you know, that these things haven't been created.
Are you saying, well, how do you explain it then, Dawkins?
Sorry?
Are you in effect just saying, so how do you explain it then, Mr. Dawkins,
no,
Professor Dawkins?
No, you're not. I'm asking, who is it? Where does his Aunt Sally come from that he's knocking? You know, this business that the world wasn't created just by chance.
He's not knocking that position. He's knocking the position. That's not even a position he's knocking. He's knocking the position of those who say it couldn't have happened by chance. Yes. Alistair McGrath. He says it. The Reverend John Polkinghorne. He says it. Yes. Loads and loads and loads of people say that. Right. I think we'll move on if I can. Just yeah. Because we're going to lose the thread, because this is the complicated bit now, and so if I don't keep going, you're going to lose it. So that's just my suggestion. Look, if you're going to design something, and then create it, even if you do so indirectly by means of the theory, you know, evolutionary processes, what you have in your mind, the structure of what's in your mind, must be at least as complex as that which you have designed. Otherwise, you haven't designed it, have you? So,
There's a mathematical proof of your second statement by John von Neumann.
Okay, that would be handy.
If anybody's mathematically inclined, okay. You are 100%.
Yeah. Right. Or if you could also wheel out Wittgenstein's picture theory, which basically also has this consequence. You know, you can't, a representation can't be less complex than the thing that it represents. That would be a consequence of Wittgenstein's theory of representation. So there are various ways in which we might try and prop this up. I'm not saying you have to accept this. I'm just trying to fill in a gap in Dawkins' argument.
I don't think it's necessarily true that God must have had all the subsequent developments in his mind.
If he planned them, he must have done.
No. He could have designed an element of randomness. And
then he didn't plan them. Yeah. Then he didn't plan those bits. They were just, you know. So, here are two questions for you. Does Dawkins' argument, as I have now developed it, establish, one, first of all, the strong thesis, and this is his thesis, his claim, it is highly improbable that God exists. Does his argument establish that, is the first question you should consider. Even if you thought that it didn't, you might still think that he's established a weaker thesis, which is that at least certain arguments for the existence of God fail, i.e. fine-tuning type arguments, because those arguments explain complexity in terms of a God who would have to be at least as complex as the complex as the thing as the, you know, the complex thing we're accounting for. So you could go for the strong thesis, or you could go for the weaker thesis. Dawkins himself goes for the strong thesis, but you might think, I'm not going to go that far, but I'm going to go at least that far. Let's now look at some of the responses to Dawkins' argument from professional philosophers. And I'm more or less just going to present them to you, and you can make up your own minds, except for the first one, which is Richard Swinburne, who is, you know, he's a very good professional philosopher and theist. He says, Dawkins criticises my view that the God whom I postulate is a simple being. I take it that his reasoning is... Notice that Swinburne has to guess what Dawkins' argument is. He's not quite sure what it is. So this is Swinburne's attempt to fill in the gap. I take it that his reasoning is that if God gets his knowledge and exercises his power in the way we do, via brains, he will need to be very, very complicated, since ordinary human brains with their limited powers of control are very complicated things. But I am not the same thing as my brain, says Swinburne. He's a dualist. I am a simple entity. I mean, he's a Cartesian dualist. I control quite a bit of my brain, but I'm not the same thing as it. So I am not, you know, the mind is simple. The brain is not. And Dawkins is making the mistake of confusing the two things. He's assuming the mind must be complicated because the brain would have to be complicated that did the representing. I'm not convinced by that at all. I don't think that Dawkins is thinking that way. Or I rather doubt it. It seems to me that to make his case for God's complexity, Dawkins does not have to assume God's mind is complex because God must have something like a brain. He merely has to assume that God's mind represents his creation, and that a representation must have as much organisational complexity as what it represents. But the thing that does the representing doesn't have to be a physical object. It could be an immaterial one. The point is, it's going to have structure, complexity. So it seems to me that Swinburne's made a mistake there. I very much doubt that that is Dawkins' thinking. And in any case, Dawkins doesn't have to argue in that kind of way. So I don't think Swinburne's response is good. That should say William Lane Craig. He says Dawkins' fundamental mistake lies in his assumption that a divine designer is an entity comparable in complexity to the universe. As an unembodied mind, God is a remarkably simple entity. As a non-physical entity, a mind is not composed of parts. Certainly, such a mind may have complex ideas, which is a good concession to make, but the mind itself is a remarkably simple entity. You can see that Craig has spotted that there was that pitfall waiting for him, and he stepped round it at the last minute, saying, the idea, that can be complicated, but the mind that has it, it's not. Which is kind of baffling, but maybe he's right, I don't know. I'll allow you to consider that. We now come to possibly the heavyweight contender here, Alvin Plantinga, again, very, very good philosopher. He says it doesn't even matter if God isn't simple. He's not conceding that God isn't simple, but he says even if God isn't simple, that's not to say that Dawkins has a good argument. He says it can still be reasonable to infer God's existence from organised complexity. And he's got this nice little thought experiment. So he says, suppose we land on an alien planet orbiting a distant star and discover machine-like objects that look and work just like tractors. Our leader says there must be intelligent beings on this planet who built those tractors. That does seem very reasonable, doesn't it? But then a first-year philosophy student objects. Hey, hold on a minute. You have explained nothing at all. Any intelligent life that designed those tractors would have to be at least as complex as they are. It is perfectly sensible in that context to explain the existence of those tractors in terms of intelligent life, comes the reply. that would have to be at least as complex as the tractor. So this is Dawkins' response to the first year. Sorry, I'm doing it now. Plantinga's response to his hypothetical first-year philosophy student. This is a perfectly reasonable inference, and it is. We can see that it is, right? It's reasonable to suppose that aliens built those tractors, and those aliens are at least as complicated as the tractors they built. So, Plantinga adds, the point is we aren't trying to give an ultimate explanation for organized complexity. We are only trying to explain one particular manifestation of it. Similarly, in invoking God as the original creator of life, we aren't trying to explain organized complexity in general, but only a particular kind of it, i.e. terrestrial life. I don't think he means, by terrestrial, I don't think he means on Earth, though. Planet-based, I suppose he means. But that was the... Sorry, I'm talking rubbish now, aren't I? I've lost the plot. That's what he says, that's the quotation. I'm pretty sure I've got that right. So, that's how Plantinga responds, to which I imagine some of you are thinking, but hang on a minute, I do want, that is what we're after. We are after an explanation of organized complexity in general. This is not like the case of the positing the aliens on the planet to account for the tractor type things. It's not like that, because what we are want to account for is organized complexity generally. Some of you are probably having that thought, but Plantinga's ahead of you. And he says, so what explains God's organized complexity? Plantinga says, if God's mind is organized complexity, nothing does. For there isn't an explanation of the existence of God. God is a necessary being. We don't explain, you know, explanation has to stop somewhere, right? It's true. Explanations have got to stop somewhere. Why not there? Explanations come to an end. For theism, they come to an end in God. Of course, the same goes for any other view. On any view, explanations come to an end. The materialist or physicalist, for example, doesn't have an explanation for the existence of elementary particles. They just are. And so the theist will say, well, okay, he's a philosopher, he's not a scientist. he might be wrong about that. But the moral would remain, wouldn't it? That explanations have to come to an end somewhere. You have to reach a point at which you say, that's just how things are. And the theist does that with respect to God, as opposed to something else. Why isn't it a reasonable conclusion to draw that God designed these complicated things, that accounts for the complexity, it explains why it exists in a way that would otherwise be deeply puzzling? You can ask, well, what accounts for God's complexity? Nothing does. That's just a brute fact. And indeed, if God is a necessary being, well, necessary beings are not the kind of things for which you need an explanation. That's, you know, if they were, they wouldn't be necessary beings, right? So by supposing that there must be a necessary being, we avoid that car crash type situation, that car crash worry. So that's Plantinga. And so I think this is the most sophisticated criticism of Dawkins. And I'm not entirely sure what I think about it myself. But before I hand it, so here's some questions for you. Look, Plantinga is right that it is reasonable to suppose that aliens designed the tractors. I'm sure that's true. Is he correct that it might then be reasonable to suppose God designed certain complex things? It's a thorny question. So we can discuss that. So my conclusions are, I think Dawkins is correct that the God hypothesis is potentially scientifically empirically accessible, and I think he's right to reject Noma. But I think that his main arguments against the God hypothesis might well be flawed, and I think Plantinga may well be onto something, but we can now discuss that. Unfortunately, I've now got a headache, so I might struggle a bit. But, that gentleman there has had his...
I think that the answer, and the answer Dawkins gives to that, is that things can arrive randomly and therefore end up in a conflict situation, and the vehicle that they arrive at that conflict is evolution. Evolution builds things from simplicity into complexity. So you could have some arbitrary beginning with no design whatsoever that ends up exactly the way we see the universe now. And that blows that argument. It's a random occurrence, and everything after it just follows based on a principle that we see operative in the universe, which is universal. And those robots were created by some evolved life. So that's William Paley's argument on another planet.
Yeah. I mean, he does say that about organized complexity, that, you know, we have a story about how it has appeared. But now, here are some worries. You can't conclude that that's the only way that organized complexity can exist. By saying we can tell a naturalistic story that accounts for the existence of organized complexity on the Earth, it doesn't follow that God's existence is improbable, which, remember, that is the conclusion that Dawkins is drawing. God's existence is improbable if he is highly complex.
His conclusion is that he must be more or at least as complex as the thing he's created, and that's mathematically correct and highly improbable. Whereas evolution...
But why is it...
...beginning that it grows into complexity and then it started from a random event.
Yeah, but why is it...
It
may be, yeah. I mean, this is thorny. This is complicated because there are a number of different questions that we've got to kind of tease out. I mean, has Dawkins refuted a certain kind of argument? And my suspicion is he might have done. I'm not sure. But then has he shown that God's existence is improbable if God is complex? Has organizational complexity. And earlier on in the paper, Plantinga says, actually, and now I'm trying to remember what he says, but he doesn't think that God's what does he say about it? It's gone now. He says, God's existence is not improbable if he's a necessary being, because the probability of a necessary being is one. That's what he says. So Dawkins has not shown that God is improbable. Yeah.
You go for the sort of most attractive thing because it's you discard the thing which is sort of more unlikely.
Yes, but remember which argument are we attacking here, or which position are we attacking here? Are we attacking that Dawkins has shown that God is improbable? Actually, that is now looking pretty suspect, that Dawkins claim. But you could point out that there's a certain kind of argument to the existence of God based on, say, fine-tuning or irreducible complexity or whatever, that, you know, why bother positing the second complicated thing to account for the complexity of the first complicated thing when you can just stick with the first complicated thing? What was the justification for introducing the second one? Now, that is a good worry, isn't it? I mean, I like that worry. But remember, first of all, that Dawkins goes way beyond that. He's not just trying to refute a certain kind of argument for the existence of God. He's saying that he can show that God's existence is improbable, and that's the claim that Plantinga is attacking.
But it requires the rules of information theory work with the metaphysical domain. That's what's implicit, isn't it? Dawkins is using the tools of information theory to show that something which is very complex is also improbable, which is very respectable empirical science.
Empirical science, yes.
Is it applicable in the metaphysical?
So that's again, that's where there's a potential get out of jail card. because you know, you might say this is all based on empirical research of the natural realm, and of course, yeah, God's just not that kind of thing.
Doesn't it get into danger of just being a circular argument? If you start by saying the existence of the universe exactly as it is very improbable, therefore it must have been designed by God, which makes him very improbable, but if it was designed by God, it isn't improbable at all, concerned. Because he designed it that way. So now it's not improbable, the universe, because God designed it, in which case he's not improbable. So, it's just to spin God altogether from this and not bother trying to refute it. Yes, it's improbable, but it's only improbable looked at from this end. If it hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here asking the damn question.
No. You know what? Plantinga picks Dawkins up for that as well in the paper, the kind of anthropic thing. And actually, Plantinga is right to do so, I think. There is this response that you get. I'm really struggling now because I'm tired. But there is this response you sometimes get to fine-tuning type arguments where people say... it's complicated. I'm having to rehearse it in my head before I say it because it's so complicated. People sometimes say, look, if things hadn't been that way, you wouldn't be here, right? This is the point you're making. And so actually it's not improbable at all that they should be that way, right? That's the kind of argument which Plantinga accuses Dawkins himself actually of running, and now you're running it as well. And it is very tempting, but actually I don't think that that's right. Because it's true that had these things been different, you wouldn't have been there. But it doesn't follow from that it isn't highly... I mean, you've got to distinguish different kinds of probability. The epistemic probability that your parents met is very high indeed. We know they did. You wouldn't be here if they hadn't, right? Probability is high, right? But there's another kind of probability we could consider, you know, the kind of chances type probability, objective probability, the chances of those two individuals happening to meet across a crowded room, their eyes. What are the odds of that? Very low, see? So there are different kinds of probability, what you might call epistemic probability and then what you might call objective or physical or some other kind of probability. And the kind of probability that's relevant here is objective probability, not epistemic. And what you're pointing out is that the epistemic probability of the universe existing is very high indeed, to which Dawkins will simply say, yeah, I know that, but its objective probability is amazingly low. Well, so if not Dawkins, then a fine tuner. They'll say the objective probability of it being that way, extraordinarily low, and the mere fact that the epistemic probability is high does not show that the objective or physical probability or whatever is low. So I don't think that kind of argument is a good argument, and I think Dawkins does run it. So I think he's wrong to do so. But once you've made that distinction, you can start to there are problems with fine-tuning type arguments. Because this idea of objective probability, what the hell is it, actually? The chances. What does that mean? When we say that, you know, something is has an objective probability or a physical probability, we are talking about a framework of the laws of nature. What are the chances of this rock falling down and hitting that one, given this particular set of laws of nature and these initial conditions, right? If you were to take those away, you can't talk about probability. But that means that you can't talk about the probability of the universe having these laws of nature. It's a mistake. It has no probabilities for you at all. It is not, the probability is neither high nor low. And that objection is made by a number of philosophers. Hugh Mellor makes that objection, and he's an expert on probability, and he knows a lot more about it than I do. He runs that objection to the fine-tuning type arguments. And so do some Christian philosophers, the McGrews, I think. They also say these fine-tuning type arguments don't work because you're taking this notion of probability and applying it outside of the domain where it makes any sense at all. So the idea that the universe is improbable, you know, we can't even say that. It makes no sense. So that would be a much better way for Dawkins to have responded to the fine-tuners, but instead he ran the rubbishy anthropic type argument. Yeah, one more question. Yes.
Cosmologists and physicists now, including Martin recently, are, if you like, positing a probable answer to that. Nothing is improbable because of this multiverse.
Yes.
Where everything that can happen does happen somewhere.
Yes. If there's a multiverse, yeah, that problem solved. So, but is there? I don't know. So anyway, thank you very much. Thank you.